Welcome to Unlikable Female Characters, the podcast featuring feminist thriller writers in conversation about women who don't give a damn if you like them. I'm Lane Fargo, and I'm here with Kristen LaBianca.
Hello.
And our guest today really needs no introduction if you've been listening to this podcast for any length of time, but I will do one anyway. Megan Abbott is the Edgar Award-winning author of the novels Give Me Your Hand, You Will Know Me, The Fever, Dare Me, and many more. Her latest novel, The Turnout, is a Read with Jenna Today Show book club pick, and it is also one of the best books I have ever read. Welcome, Megan.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. What a great intro. Thank you. So appreciated.
We're both completely obsessed with The Turnout. We could not put it down.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, yay.
And I have to say, like, speaking for both of us and pretty much everyone else I know who's a thriller writer, like, when we heard that you were writing a book about ballet, like, I just lost my damn mind. I was like, what could be better than a Megan Abbott book about ballet? So could you talk a little bit about, like, the genesis of this idea?
Yeah, I guess we all have this fascination with ballet, many of us. It does seem to be very, very common in its light side and its dark side. And I always wanted to do something set in it, but I didn't really know what the story would be. And I wanted to avoid various cliches, and I didn't want to cover ground that had been trod with Black Swan or Red Shoes or elsewhere. But eventually, sort of the story, I found you know, the sort of situation I was interested in, which was really about the way that women judge other women for their romantic or sexual choices, which is really coming off the, do you remember that Dirty John podcast from a few years back?
Yes, I wanted to ask you about this because I attended some of your events last week with Gillian Flynn and Laura Lippman, and you brought this up, and I thought it was so, so fascinating. So yeah, please.
Yeah, it was, you know, I love true crime. So of course I love Dirty John. I was really surprised at it's always when something becomes wildly popular that you know, people who don't necessarily tend to read true crime or all kinds of people are coming upon it. But there was a real intensity of feeling in these comment sections, a lot of anger. And then it's a podcast about a serial predator. It was like a really awful man and abusive and murderous, but it seemed like all the comments were really very angry at the women who had fallen for him. And that's really where all the ire was directed. And it seemed so strange to me, and started to think about what it was really about. And, you know, it seemed like some way of saying, you know, this would never happen to me because you didn't see these signs, but I would. You're dumb and I'm smarter, which, you know, was sort of a fascinating dynamic to me. So I was thinking of a situation where a sister could be judging another sister that way. And then I thought, oh, maybe they run a ballet school.
Perfect. So the two sisters in the book, so we have Dara, who is sort of the alpha sister, I would say. And then Marie, who is the more, like, she's the one who's being caught up with this con man, this contractor who comes in, and we can talk more about him later. But I know when I was reading it, I related much more strongly to Dara. I like immediately connected with her, and kind of because she's so judgmental almost, I really related to that. I don't know, Kristen, if you felt the same way.
No, I totally did. Yeah. That really like harsh initial impulse to judge someone, I feel like was very, very relatable. And I mean, I would hope that I would have more empathy than that, but I mean, probably not, to be honest.
Do you have one that you relate more to? Megan, I know you like chose to tell it mostly through Dara's voice, even though it's third person.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have both Dara and Marie. I mean, I think we all do, but it's sometimes the Dara is easier to access. So she was surprisingly easy to. In fact, my agent's usually my first reader, and he was an editor first, and he's a sort of really good reader. And one of his first comments was, "Dara is so mean. Why is she so mean?" And I'm like, "Wait, is she mean? She doesn't seem mean to me. She's just someone who." Is, you know, she's very disciplined and very controlled and has a very strong sense of how things should be. And those characters are really interesting to write because you wonder where their cracks are, because they're right. Certainly there. I mean, the reason you develop that level of control is to cover up the cracks. So she was so fascinating to write because I really didn't know what her secrets were. They sort of revealed themselves to me through her.
And seeing it through her eyes, it's almost hard to understand why Marie is so entranced with this contractor that she falls into the affair with. But you wonder, like, you know, if we were seeing it from Marie's point of view, we would see all the things that she finds attractive about him. But Dara's so repulsed by him. We're just seeing it through her eyes. So yeah. I found that fascinating, especially that first sex scene. I don't want to give anything away, but it was so viscerally written. It was
yes.
That is quite a sex scene.
Well, it is, yeah, point of view is really important, and I really did kind of want it to be. I always loved books like that, even as a kid, where you keep changing how you feel about the characters as the sort of different facets of them emerge, sort of, because we're all so messy and complicated, as you know. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted that to be a feature of it, where it's, you know, we can call it unreliable narrator, but really we're all unreliable narrators of our own experience. And really it's just, you know, her history with Marie and her history with her family and with everything, it so infuses the way she sees this man. So I really wanted that in there, and for her to give us this view of this, and then we would have to later figure out how much of that is Dara and how much of that is really Derek and Marie.
I love how there's kind of this element of voyeurism throughout. Like, Dara is perceiving Marie's reactions to Derek, sort of, she's like catching glimpses of it and building her own, you know, opinions that way. But at the same time, Dara feels like Derek is watching her or watching all of them. And then you kind of have that paired with the whole idea of a ballet school where it's all about watching someone. I just think that's really a really fascinating atmosphere in which to set a thriller.
Yeah, it was so interesting. And, you know, the ballet dancers, their whole life is having mirrors all around them. So they have a really different relationship to seeing than we do because of that. And they're so used to looking and being looked at and displaying themselves. So it sort of, you know, what sort of those boundaries are for these dancers, and certainly for Dara and Marie, seemed really interesting. Especially because she and her sister and her husband, their lives are so enmeshed. They're so tightly knotted, and outsiders, you know, really feel like outsiders. And that's why someone like Derek can really feel like a threat, because their world is so small.
Mm-hmm. And being a ballet dancer, it seems like the kind of thing where it's never just your profession or like a hobby. It is your identity. Like, that's who they are completely. It's not like, you know, they're ballerinas and then they just go home and let their hair down and are totally relaxed. It's like, you just, I'm picturing them the whole book just like walking with a really straight back and very controlled, and like probably the way they brush their teeth, the way they lie down in bed, like everything super controlled. So that makes a very fascinating, extreme kind of character.
Yeah, and it's always like, you know, whenever I will be by Lincoln Center and see ballet dancers in the wild, and they do look different. They have that quality of feeling like a something apart from us, you know, with those long necks and their feet turned out, and all of that is so, it marks them.
I know one thing we're both so fascinated by in your writing in general is how you create this atmosphere of extreme just dread and tension. Like, it almost, it's like oppressive almost when you're reading your books. It's incredible. And it's with this one, especially, like the real action, you know, comes later in the story. Like, a lot of it in the beginning is just these conversations or people looking at each other from across the room or through the doorway or whatever. Like, there's not a lot of action on the page, but it feels so intense and emotional. And I just, how do you do that?
Tell us.
It is such an interesting, you know, it's sort of getting that room for the reader to fill in. You have to create those spaces for the reader to fill in with their own stuff, their own worries and fears. Mm. And it's a lot about creating those spaces to come into the story, for the reader to come in. Suppose it's sort of like, I love movies, and I love Hitchcock, and he would always talk about that, about like opening these doors for the viewers, and they'll fill it in with their own anxieties and obsessions. But you have to open those doors, so you have to create that space. And so it's a lot about revision, about cutting back, holding back, being patient, and having trust in the reader to sort of come along. I think that, and it helps when you're in a kind of rarefied environment to create that atmosphere, because it already feels like nothing normal can go on here. You know, this is not a place where you're going to kick back and open a bag of Doritos. You know, it's just not that kind of world.
I read a piece that you had written in The Cut recently about like the perfectionism of ballet and just perfectionism in general. And I think that's really also an interesting place to start with thrillers, because, you know, with characters who are so like high strung or tightly wound, or, you know, whatever kind of adjective you want to use, these points of tension like create all kinds of interesting opportunities for storytelling and conflict. And I just like, I love that about your books, that you have, you know, these women who are in like very high pressure situations, sort of, you know, them being high strung is just like, that's how they are. And then something happens and it kicks it up a notch. What do you think it is about like that intensification of a situation that really makes good storytelling?
Yeah, I mean, I always hope it's good, but what it really is how I experience the world. You know, that is how I feel all the time. It's so funny. Sort of like you never realize, we all are so specific, and you never really realize it until other people say, wait, this doesn't feel comfortable. sort of an anxious person by nature, and I'm sort of obsessive person, and certainly struggle with my own perfectionism. So it's really easy for me to enter a place of being tightly wound. It's much harder. I think it would be really hard for me to write like a hangout book. because it's just not my, it's not my jam. And it's, so it does come natural to me. And then, yeah, it's really a matter of just what you said. It, you know, when you're writing a crime novel, it's wired in that things are going to be pushed even further. So you've got a pressure cooker in a very hot, overheated kitchen. So they're bound to explode.
I'm just realizing, is this why we all write thrillers and crime novels, because we're all like anxious messes? All
really anxious. I think so, honestly.
Well, then the pandemic should have made it easier, because we're more anxious now, but it has not made it easier. What is going on? Not fair. Well,
I mean, they do say, I mean, it is sort of the thing that thriller and crime writers tend to be the nicest people. In some ways, we get a lot of, it's very, and much an exorcism, maybe, sort of getting all that out on the page. So there's that, at least. I mean, I don't think the last year and a half there's any exorcism enough, but you know, hopefully that will always be this way.
Yeah, I read that piece in The Cut as well, and I really loved how you talked about women having to be perfect but not seem like they're trying, which is something we talk a lot about on this show. I mean, basically the conceit of the show is we talk about unlikable female characters, which we have found to mean over we've been doing this for like 2 years, Kristen. It's basically any woman who doesn't fit into this like very narrow line of like acceptable behavior. She's either like too much or not enough, or she's trying too hard or not trying hard enough, or whatever it is. So I thought that was really an interesting point to make, that and to tie it to ballet, where it's supposed to look so effortless, but there's so much work, like constant work and effort behind it.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of, figured that out as I wrote it. I never really write about myself, and they had wanted me to talk about really why I personally wanted to write a book about ballet. And it was really the act of writing it that made me figure out what, because I don't have any connection in that I was ever good at ballet or dance or anything to do with moving my body in space and time. So it was just not that. And so like, what was it? And it was really one of those where through the writing, I was thinking of like what rang so true about reading all these ballet memoirs and doing all the research. And that was the thing that I kept connecting to. It's that sort of double bind of needing to be flawless, feeling like you need to be flawless, but also making it look so easy, which then, of course, as we all know, means, you know, more stuff gets dumped on you often in life because of that, and the sort of unfairness of it all, but how much we're in part doing it to ourselves.
And enforcing it, like, as women, for other women. I mean, I think, yeah. That's not just a performance for men. I don't think men even notice as much as other women do, that like that performance of perfectionism, yeah. And everything. We were both at, there's a BoucherCon panel. I guess it was 2019. That's the last time we successfully had a BoucherCon, right? That you were on talking about unlikable female characters. And you said something about that you, like, that women tend to criticize other women for being unlikable because it's like, we can't show everyone what we're really like. We're like breaking the code by showing how awful women can be. Yeah. Sort of like cracking that image. I thought that was a really great point.
Yeah, I always think about that. I'm a real fan of The Real Housewives of New York and Beverly Hills and Potomac. And I've had so many women say to me, you know, how can you watch that? It makes us look so bad. And like, it's such an interesting response, and I get it. But I don't know. I think the more we let things be messy and allow for complication, you know, the mission of your show, you know, we can sort of take that away. And I mean, we don't need to create more freedom for Real Housewives, but
they're doing okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing all right. But I just think it helps us all to, I think to sort of be frank about these things and to be open and to show our imperfections and not staged imperfections, but real ones.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. That's something we celebrate a lot on this show. Just women being messy, women being assholes, women being judgmental. I mean, all of those things. But I know something we've talked about before that we struggle with as writers and then in reading books as well is like you want to create a lot of conflict, especially if you're writing a crime novel. And it's much more interesting, we think, to have conflict between women, right, Kristen?
Yes, for sure.
But then you don't want to lean into these stereotypes of like catty behavior, like girls fighting girls, whatever. So, I mean, you do that so well in your books, Megan, where you have this authentic character-driven conflict between women, whether it's Beth and Addie and Jeremy or Kit and Diane and Give Me Your Hand. And it never goes into that mean girl kind of stereotype. I was wondering if you could talk about your approach to creating that sort of girl-on-girl conflict, if you will.
Yeah, it is. I'm glad it feels that, because that's just a thing. I never want to indulge in that. And, you know, I do think it's so much about tone and how you're presenting it. And, you know, there's just this sort of, it's really become sort of a kitsch version of it now that mean girls and bullying and you know, the old one, cat fights, it's also diminishing of women and girls and their complexities. And it's sort of, you know, I think it's sort of, if your spirit is right in doing it, it will come through. It's the only thing I can say about it, because it just has to be earned. And it has to be for the right reasons. And when there's a threat, there has to be a real threat. And there has to be consequences, too. So that all seems really important. It's sort of like, you know, if you've ever seen a physical fight in person, you know how scary it is and how real it is. And that, you know, it makes you never again want to do the cheap version of this.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point that you have to earn it with that kind of conflict, because, you know, Dara is not judgmental of Marie just because she's a judgmental bitch. Like, she knows her sister, and that's part of why she has that reaction. She's like, oh, here goes Marie again, you know, falling apart over this thing. Like, her reaction is really based on a deep understanding and like their relationship being, you know, they really understand each other.
Right. And they're, you know, and ultimately Dara's own insecurities and fears too at play. And those are the sort of the layers that you want to sort of be able to have the reader be able to unpeel. That first it feels like this, and then it feels like, you know, then it feels like, oh, I get it, you know, and then later you're thinking, oh, now I see why Dara is so hard on her. And you know, we all play roles in families, and you get really trapped in your role, and it's really hard to break out of it. You know how, you know, you can be anything else in the real world out there, but you know, if you are considered the brat or the bossy one in your family or this or that, like, you can't escape it. So, you know, since their whole worlds have been with each other, they are doubly trapped.
Yeah, I think that's so true. Like, because whenever you go home for Christmas or something, I think we all just revert to our worst adolescent selves. And then they've never left. Like, they live in the same house that they grew up in, where a lot of crazy things went down that we won't spoil. So they're just trapped in those roles from childhood and continue to act them out. Yeah. I did think it was interesting in this book, because so often in your books, it's primarily conflict between women. And in this one, you've created this really interesting male villain, very memorable. How did you design Derek? Because it seems like you just picked like everything that would bother Dara the most and like put it all into this man, which I love.
He came fully formed to me. That doesn't always happen, but I knew Derek.
Really?
Yeah, I just and I really enjoyed writing him so much. I really got a kick out of him. I had to actually scale back. There was too much Derek at one point. He's really the opposite of the most of the characters I write. Someone had said at one point, "Oh, your characters are all so beautiful, always." And I wanted him to be kind of like a really irregular guy, and with a middle-aged belly, and he's sort of stomping, and his clothes aren't great, and but that he owns it, and that he would have this sort of swagger. I'm always so fascinated by misplaced swagger. Shouldn't have it, but do. And it was really interesting. I've always been interested in people who are sort of seductive or manipulative, how they're able to target the vulnerabilities in other people so quickly. And that dynamic is so compelling to me. So it was really fun to write him. And those characters, they're always too, he's a blowhard or is this or that, but there's also, they always also get at certain truths that other people can't, and that there is always a touch of what's so painful about him is that he sees things that Dara knows are there when she would rather not anyone see. And so that I wanted to be part of him too, so that he would have these layers as well.
He's very perceptive.
Yeah, he's very perceptive and shrewd about, identifying the cracks within Dara that she either thinks no one can see or just hopes no one can see. And I think that's part of why she finds him so immediately unsettling, is he can like get right at that part of her.
Yeah, exactly. It's just sort of like he's sticking his thumb in, and it was sort of it was just an accident, but it did turn out that, he's a contractor at his renovation. So he's sort of, he's sort of tearing apart their studio and at the same time sort of tearing down all these sort of walls and these castle walls that Dara has built around their lives. And what could be more threatening than that?
I just went through a big home renovation and it was a little like too soon for me to read this. No. It didn't go as badly as in the book, but it feels very like violating to have, even if they're doing a great job and they're nice and not like trying to manipulate you like this guy in the book is. It's very violating to have someone in your house like tearing out walls and just like all up in your space.
Right. And you have to trust them implicitly because none of us really know how that stuff works either, unless you know something about construction yourself. It is like a great car mechanic or a great plumber or a great OBGYN for that matter. Like they're going in these vulnerable places and you have to trust that they know what they're doing, and you do feel so vulnerable. So if you find a good one, you should keep him forever.
Absolutely. That's what's interesting about the physical stuff that you mentioned about him having like the middle-aged belly and everything, where Dara and Marie and Charlie are so sculpted and have like worked really hard to perfect their bodies, and then he is just sort of like letting it all hang out there, but he has that swagger. He thinks he's attractive and has this like sexual power, which is something that like it seems like only men really where they're just like, I don't care what I look like, I'm hot, and just go like get all the women they want. It's kind of amazing how the patriarchy works.
It is. I mean, the straight women who respond to it, which I have not been immune to that in my lifetime. But it's sort of a powerful thing how much confidence can matter in those situations. That's why I call them con artists.
That's true. Well, I think we wanted to get into some questions about your writing process, because we have a lot of writers who listen to this show, writers and aspiring writers, and you're, of course, one of our favorite writers who we talk about all the time on the show. So what is your process like? It sounded like from some of the other interviews that I've seen of yours that you start with kind of a small piece, like a voice or an idea, and you kind of just like see what happens. Is that how you generally do it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know any other way to do it. You know, you know, it's sort of, how do you create a novel? You know, it's
I don't know.
If anyone finds out, please tell me.
I mean, I guess for me, it's sort of, you know, they always say write what you know, but for me, it's sort of write what you're curious about. And so I'm always trying to go into a story or a world or a voice that is not natural to me or familiar to me, and figure it out. So sort of following what's exciting and keep going from there and what seems to be working. And it's a lot of trial and error. It would be great if it weren't, but I don't think there's really any other way. I mean, you could plot out a story for the novel. You could create a plot, but it wouldn't have that life. It's sort of that spark that you need. And that really, for me, only comes by trial and error and listening to, you know, sort of intuition stuff like this is exciting to me. I don't know why yet, but I'm going to, you know, keep going here and just hoping. But ultimately, if I don't find a voice to tell it from, whether it's first person or second or third person close, you know, if I don't have that, I can't do it at all. So that sometimes it's like switching the POV around a bit, too.
So do you just write a ton then and have to pare it back a lot, it sounds like?
Yeah. And I try, as the years go by, I try to do more thinking than writing, you know, try to, you know, I think there's a part of it in the early days, especially, where you feel like word count is all that matters. And it does matter a lot, but I also think a lot of stuff counts as writing, which is, you know, taking a walk and thinking about it, going to that matinee to clear your head and see something that sort of shakes the cobwebs loose, and all these things that sort of help get you into that state you need to be. Feels really important to me.
I love that, because I tend to get really caught up in the word count, and if I'm just thinking, I'm like, oh, I'm wasting time. But it is sometimes in those moments where you step away from the desk, like I had a great idea while doing the dishes last night, I had another one while I was at a movie last weekend, like it just, you kind of have to get away from the screen.
Yes,
sometimes.
Always. I mean, it always comes like the minute you leave the computer. So it's sort of, the more you know that, the more you force yourself to do it, and you let your brain sort of roam a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of why the pandemic has just been so hard on writers, because we don't have as many places to go to step away from the computer screen. I mean, it's getting a little better now, but for so much of last year, it's like, it was like me and my house and my computer screen. And that was it. There's not any new material coming in. And it felt very much like, wow, I have no ideas.
No, it's really hard, because you do need to see new and different things. They don't have to be beautiful things or exotic things, but you do need to see things and be other places. I think that you need to have experiences that are not just solitary. So I do think it was definitely hard for me. I remember the minute things started to open up, you know, they opened MoMA here in New York, and I remember the first time I went last fall when they reopened partially, or whatever it was. Time means nothing now, but it was the most ecstatic experience I ever had in my life, because I hadn't seen art in person, and so I would just see it on screens and in so long that it was just so glorious, and it was a great reminder of how important that is.
Yeah, I miss live performance so much, like going to the theater, and it was great to read about ballet in your book. It made me miss it even more, though.
Me too.
And I know that you are you adapted Dare Me, and you're going to be adapting The Turnout yourself. Is that right?
Yes, working on it now. So it's a limited series.
Amazing. Okay. So how do you approach, is there like a different approach to writing for the screen? I ask selfishly because I'm doing this right now for one of my books.
Yeah, it's wildly different. I mean, it's really, could hardly be more different, I think, because, you know, scripts are so much about structure, and they're so, they move, you know, you have so little room, things really got to move in a certain way. They have to, you know, and they're just sort of opposite of the intimacy of the novel. So much of it for me always is starting to imagine it visually, and to use visual storytelling, and to really think about moments, think in terms of scenes rather than the way you would in a novel. So for me, it's really different, I think, because I do tend to write really sort of in the head, you know, really sort of interior books. It's particularly hard for me to break out of it. So I have to really come at it from a very different angle. And takes some time, takes some figuring out.
Yeah, you're putting so much trust in your collaborators and in the actors as well. Cause like in a book you can explain, I mean, you know, we don't wanna
yeah.
You're gonna show, not tell, but you can kind of, you can show a lot more about who the character is and their worldview, and you can get their thoughts and everything. And then when it's just a visual, you're leaving that so much in someone else's hands and would worry about maybe the character being misunderstood, or I don't know. It is a whole other puzzle.
It is. And to get there, to get into production, it actually has to work on the page of the script. So you really have to make it come alive in some way in the script itself, or it will never reach that stage. So how do you convey interior states in a script is a real trick. And I'm always watching movies, that returning to movies I love to sort of see how they did it, to see how it works. So that's always really helpful.
What are some that you think do it particularly well?
Well, I mean, I would say pick whatever ones you love. But I tend to sort of go to like the sort of beloved screenwriters or writer directors. I mean, Billy Wilder is a favorite of mine, and all of his, he was a writer before he was a director, and he's such a tight, great storyteller. His sort of 10 rules for storytelling, which is always floating around the web, I share it every year on his birthday, is just great. And it's really so much about working with the audience and holding things back from them. And it's full of this great advice, and I kind of love it and love him. But I think whatever movie or show that you love is the one that, you know, ones you want to keep returning to and sort of figure out how they're put together.
I did want to say that I think there are so many like visual elements just sort of built into the world of The Turnout already that will make such a powerful piece on screen. Like so many details about their shoes and the way that like they hammer their shoes and cutting the shoes with a razor blade. I just feel like that's all so like visually poetic, and it'll be really cool to sort of see that come to life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is sort of one of the benefits of this being a very visual art, as with sports. So I think that will be so much fun, because I know I watch endless YouTube videos of dancers preparing their pointe shoes, and I was fascinated by all of them.
It's surprisingly violent.
Yes,
it is. It really is.
Also, it was really interesting to me that like pointe shoes don't last very long. I guess I never really thought about that. Obviously I'm no ballerina, but that's fascinating. Like you would think like, oh, you know, you get a pair of shoes and you use them for a while, but it's like really not like that.
No, they're destroyed. And it's just, you know, you can go and look at these beautiful factories in France or Italy, these craftsmen making these beautiful shoes. And then the dancers sort of strip them down and bend them and twist them. And then they put them on and they dance, and then they're in shreds. So it's really just like the briefest of all life cycles. They go out in a blaze of glory, though.
And that sort of like fits with the ephemeral nature of all live performance, but certainly ballet. Mm-hmm. It's like you go out and do it and you are in terrible pain, I assume. I've never done it. And then it's just, it's over, you know, it's there in the minds of the people who saw the performance, but that's it.
Yes. Yes. No, absolutely. It's, yeah, I miss it too.
Yeah, I could just see this book playing out on screen so clearly as I was reading it. I mean, just the mood of it and the visual contrast between the characters, not just Derek and the sisters, but like the two sisters themselves. I just I can't wait.
Oh, great. I'm so glad.
Yeah, super excited. I also want to say one quick thing about the movie Black Swan, which obviously is a very different type of story. And like, other than being in the ballet world, like, I don't think there are a lot of similarities. I think they're very different stories, of course. But one thing about that movie that I find so compelling is in the early parts where she's rehearsing, instead of having like a soundtrack or even just the music that she would be dancing to, there's no sound. All you can hear is like Natalie Portman's breathing. And I feel like that is so like, it creates such like a claustrophobic, scary feeling, even though like literally nothing has happened. She's just dancing. But just the fact that instead of there being, you know, this sweeping classical music behind her, you can just hear like her very like anxious, like labored breath. And I think that that is like a super interesting way to use the medium of film to sort of get that across.
Absolutely. And I love Black Swan. And I, you know, I think a lot of movies with ballet sort of teeter into horror, you know, and I think it is because that you have this intensity and you have the body, the toll on the body. And I kind of love how close it sort of can tilt into that. It's sort of built in. I mean, even the most beloved ballet movie of all, The Red Shoes, is, you know, really quite, it has quite a gory element to it. And it's sort of, you know, based on The Red Shoes, the very dark fairy tale about a young woman who has to have her feet chopped off so they'll stop dancing. So it's sort of, I mean, all that's sort of built into it. And so I think it would be, you know, I know ballet dancers always hate Black Swan and they complain about it. And I get it. You know, we always hate to see our profession or our sort of portrayed on film in any way, but or in fiction. But I do think there is a darkness that built into ballet that's part of its draw, its sumptuousness, the sacrifice that they go through, and I love all that.
That anxious, heavy breathing is basically me while I was reading The Turnout.
Yes, same.
There were just moments of that book that had me so tense. It felt almost like horror, even though it's just the personal stakes between the characters. Like, I don't want to give any spoilers, but when the contractor enters like a space where he shouldn't be around the midpoint of the book, that scene had me, I was like flipping pages like, oh my God, he's in there. What are they going to do? Yeah. I'm curious. So, I mean, all of your books are, it's safe to say, like pretty dark. You create these atmospheres of dread. Do you like take that on really as you're writing? I know you were saying that you kind of bring your own anxieties to it, but is it something that like affects you a lot and you feel like you have to shake it off? Do you kind of like live in that space while you're writing the book?
Yeah, you know, it sort of connects to that, the earlier point about that sort of the anxiety. I mean, it doesn't feel that dark to, it doesn't feel darker to me than, I don't know, I don't find the kind of darkness I write about scary. I find it compelling, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So I mean, real life scares me a lot more than but I will say too, it's always hard to write big scenes of violence. Not because I'm sort of wary of violence. I mean, I am in my personal life, but it's really hard to make it work, to really sort of sell it. So I tend to it can be a week or more, 2 weeks. I'm still stuck in that one scene and it can feel very claustrophobic. Like I'm stuck in that space it's happening in. And that can be hard and heavy. And it's always try to remind myself that, you know, maybe I just don't look at that today, you know, and sort of take a break from it and come in with fresh eyes. So I do have that and try to attend to that fresh eyes can be really good for that.
Yeah, I think Kristen and I have both been over the course of the pandemic trying to write projects that were like pretty dark and depressing, and sometimes it just feels like you're in a hole and you can't get out. That's how my experience anyway. So
yeah, for sure.
That was on my mind as I was reading The Turnout. I was like, how does she create this and still like is a functional human? Because I can't do this. As functional humans as writers ever are.
Right.
Yes. That's exactly.
Your early books were sort of in the noir tradition, historical mysteries set in that sort of like pulpy space. And then you had with Dare Me really a distinct transition to contemporary stories in these very intense female environments. Like what kind of prompted you to do that? Or is it really just about sort of chasing the types of stories that are capturing your own attention at any time?
Yeah, it was really, I know people often point to it and I get it because it feels like this choice or this big decision or something, but it really was rather like I always want to find something new and interesting and compelling, and I always hoped that I could bring my noir with me, and then And it seemed like, you know, it was an easy transition to teenagers because, you know, that's how life feels when you're a teenager. You do live in these sort of extremes of emotion and you know, you have reason to be paranoid, like in noir, everyone is sort of paranoid, and there's all this sort of, so it was a natural transition, but then it just kept going. So once I realized that I didn't have to stay in the historical period of noir to sort of write noir, then it was a freedom to go other places, which was great. Though I definitely would love to write something set in the past again one day.
Yeah, noir seems like something that can really be, it's kind of like gothic in that way. Like it can be in any story in any time. It can be in like a sci-fi story or something in medieval times or whatever, because it's like a mood. It's like,
yeah,
a,
for sure.
Feeling.
Yeah, it's like this mood of characters making like increasingly bad decisions with increasingly yes. higher stakes.
Exactly. Perfectly put.
Awesome. Well, the final question we ask everyone is, what are you working on now? If you can tell us, if it's top secret, that's fine.
Yeah. Well, I'm working on a few TV projects, and starting a new novel. So, which is too early to even know what it is. But yeah, the turnout for TV and then a few other ones. We'll see where they go. But hope to get, I'm really excited to get back into the novel and to get back into that quiet space. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're excited for whatever you put out next. We're all huge fans. And thank you so much for coming and talking to us today.
Oh, this was so much fun. Thank you guys so much.
That's it for this episode of Unlikable Female Characters. Don't forget to subscribe, and you can also follow us on Twitter at UnlikableFCPod for updates, book recommendations, and angry feminist rants. Our website is unlikablefemalecharacters.com, and we're also on Instagram at UnlikableFemaleCharacters. Thanks for listening.